It's a brand new recording filled with works by a composer that you may have never heard of. The repertoire is written by Walter Kaufman, and it's very exciting to hear this new music and very challenging for the Arc Ensemble to perform it. Simon Weinberg is the artistic director of the Arc Ensemble, and he tells us more about how they unearthed this music and this project featuring musicians in exile. Would you please start off by just kind of introducing yourself? Who is Simon Weinberg?
I am the artistic director of the Arc Ensemble, Artists of the Royal Conservatory, which is the ensemble in residence at Canada's Royal Conservatory of Music. And my job is to manage and program and generally direct and curate the Arc Ensemble. That's my job.
You've also had a very diverse career, haven't you? Are you the same Simon Weinberg who plays guitar? And
I'm a recovering guitarist, yeah.
Oh, I see. So you aren't playing anymore? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not. I've had some hand issues, and I kind of got into this research and writing and directing bit, and it was just taking up so much time that I thought, why not put the guitars in their boxes and visit them occasionally? So that's what I've been doing.
You have been the artistic director of the Arc Ensemble since 2003. What is the purpose of this ensemble?
Well, this was an idea that was dreamt up by the president of the Royal Conservatory, Peter Simon, and he approached me with the idea of establishing an in-house group that would promote the quality and professionalism of the basic faculty of the conservatory and show them off to their best advantage. So he came to me with this idea, or rather I was approached to offer suggestions as to how this might be realized. And my first response was, if you want to have an ensemble, we need to do something that is a little bit out of the box, because if we're just going to record Brahms and Dvorak and the trusted favorites, we're going to be, you know, competing with all the gorillas out there. And I mean, there are 150 recordings of any of those works that you care to mention. So initially, the idea was to do works that were a little unknown or rarities. But then I got clued into the fact that there was this huge amount of music that had been written by composers who had left Europe in the 30s and who had been marginalized over the years and whose works had really been largely forgotten. And that developed into the main thrust of what we do. And that's what we've been doing really since about 2006. This new recording of works by Walter Kaufman is, it fits into the pattern of what we've done before. It's all unknown repertoire. It's never been recorded before. So it's completely fresh to the repertoire, which in and of itself is a huge challenge. I mean, it's a huge challenge for the players. It's a challenge for labels because they have to promote something that is completely unknown. So there are all sorts of inbuilt hostilities, if you like, to new repertoire. We tend to focus on stuff that we know rather than stuff that we don't know. That makes it really exciting as well.
Tell me how this is challenging for the Arc Ensemble to perform. What makes it so challenging?
Well, I think, I mean, you have to go back to basics. When students come to a university or conservatory, they're largely presented and they largely play stuff that their teachers and their professors are familiar with. And what we do is play music that no one really knows. So they actually have to decide whether they want to play the music to begin with. I come up with suggestions. I send them scores, or we get together for a reading session, and no one really knows the music. So they basically have to tell me whether they think this is worth pursuing or not. And I go with their final decision. If I think something is wonderful and they think it's crap, then they rule. I mean, that decision is the one that qualifies the repertoire. So once they've decided that there's potential in the music, then they have to actually work on trying to find out what the composer is intending. And there's no, you see, there's no performance tradition behind it. You know, it's all fresh. So there's no one saying, oh, well, I heard, you know, Isaac Stern play it in this way. He played it slightly faster than Ben Heifetz did. There's none of that kind of subtlety of a performance tradition. It's completely unknown. So you have to actually come at it and invent the music. You are in a much more creative role than you would normally be.
So they are actually creating sort of the precedent-setting recording then.
Exactly, which puts a lot of responsibility on them. Because, you know, it comes out and then you think, oh, my God, you know, that should have been a lot faster. Or why did we play it like that? I mean, oh, dear, you know. There are all those conversations that happen afterwards because, you need to perform and work on a work before you can actually present it in a kind of fully gestated form.
How did you discover the works of Walter Kaufmann?
Well, I'm very reluctant to use the word discover because when you have a composer like Kaufmann who has an archive at Indiana University, which occupies God knows how many feet of shelving, you don't discover that. It's there. It's just that nobody's bothered to look at it. A friend of mine at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, Brett Werb, who is really, he's the person that people go to when they're trying to find some kind of answer, but they've looked in all the books and there's nothing that solves the problem. They go to Brett. And Brett came to me and said, do you know this guy, Walter Kaufmann? And I said, never heard of him. And he said, well, you know, I don't know any of his music, but you know, there's all this stuff in Indiana. Do you think we should go and have a look at it? And so I did. I ordered some stuff. I went online and saw what they had, and I ordered some PDFs, and then we both went, and I met Brett in Bloomington, and we went to the library, and we spent a day or two just going through all this stuff. And it was clear to me there was some real potential. I didn't realize, you know, how exciting the music was, but there were some really strong indications that this was a guy that was really worth looking at. Then I started reading his biography, and one of the curious things about these sort of unknown composers is that their music is unknown, but their biographies are really quite well known. So you go online, you can find all sorts of stuff about Walter Kaufmann. You can find newspaper articles about him. There are people who've written about his work in India, but you try and find some actual audio, and you'd be really hard pressed to find anything. This is true of a lot of the composers that I've dealt with over the years, is that their biographical details somehow excuses, you know, the biographer of having to look at the music. Say, oh, we know all about him. You know, we know about, but we don't know anything about the music, but we know all about him. And that was particularly true of Kaufmann.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Kaufmann, and then we will talk about his music, because the reason his music was at Indiana University is because he eventually ended up teaching there, but the route there was really interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about this composer?
Well, it was definitely a circuitous route, and he had wanted to end up in the United States for some 26, 27 years before he finally arrived there. He was born in Karlsbad, which is now Karlovy Vary in the Czech Republic. But then it was the Sudetenland, which was a German-speaking population in Czechoslovakia. And that caused all sorts of problems for the people who lived there. But in 1934, he left Prague, where he was building a nice career for himself. And he could see the Nazi menace on the horizon, and he decided he was going to take some time off and go to Bombay. And why Bombay? Because he was fascinated by Indian music. And it was quite easy to get a visa there in those days when, with people trying to leave Europe. Bombay offered the possibility of an easy visa. And he got on a boat in Venice and sailed to Bombay, and he spent 12 years in India. He definitely wanted to leave earlier, but he was stuck there during the war, and he left, wrote to his friend Albert Einstein, who he'd met in Berlin in his time as a student there, and Einstein had tried to get him jobs in the United States, but failed miserably. And eventually he ended up in London after the war, spent a little time in Halifax, Nova Scotia, then moved to Winnipeg, where he spent 8 years. You can imagine kind of moving from the heat of Bombay to the frozen climes of Winnipeg. I mean, that's always been a slightly weird one for me to get my mind around. So he was in Winnipeg for about 8 years, conducting the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra. He was their first professional conductor. And then a job came up, probably through some buddies that he'd had from Europe, people who had already established themselves in the United States. And he was offered a job in Bloomington, and he left and settled there in 1956, I think, 57.
You mentioned Albert Einstein, and he also had connections with conductor Bruno Walter. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because they both impacted his career.
I mean, he worked as an assistant to Bruno Walter for a while. I'm not quite sure how long that relationship lasted, but certainly his relationship with Einstein, which began in the 1920s, lasted until Einstein's death in 1955. And there's a lot of correspondence between the two of them. And apparently when he got his gig in Winnipeg, he phoned Einstein and said, you know, I got this great job, and Einstein was very happy for him. And so they did have a very cordial relationship, and Einstein was very supportive of him. There's another famous connection with Franz Kafka, because he married Franz Kafka's niece. The marriage was not successful. His second marriage was to a Canadian pianist who he stole from Canada, and they went to live in Bloomington together. I don't think the Canadians were very pleased that he, A, left the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra, and B, took one of their, you know, great pianists with him, a woman called Frieda Trebel, who was really a terrific pianist and had worked with Chicago and Minneapolis orchestras. And I mean, she'd done really well for herself. And then she left and went to Indiana with Walter.
What is it about Walter Kaufman's music that makes it unique?
Yeah, it's difficult to use that word unique, but in this case, I really think that there's probably a case to use it. I mean, although there are elements of Stravinsky and a bit of Bartok, and a bit, you know, you hear these influences, but what really defines a lot of his music is this quest to meld these two cultures, the Western culture in which he'd been trained in conservatory, the Berlin Hochschule, and the Indian traditions and Oriental traditions, which he had learnt something about while he was at university, but then educated himself with all sorts of trips into the interior and writing down the tunes that he had heard and the ragas. And he wrote extensively about this. This was not just somebody who was, you know, interested in learning how to play a few notes on the sitar and, you know, being self-proclaiming themselves as an Indian, as someone who was interested in Indian music. He was really into it in a very, very deep and almost primal way. He wanted to get right inside it, and he actually learnt Indian notation. He learnt about the instruments. He learnt how to write for them, and he integrated Indian music into his own in such a way that the two actually joined together in a way that is really quite remarkable and which no one at the time was doing. So, you know, we talk about fusion, but this really was a fusion, and long before the word had any of the resonance that it has now.
We hear that fusion in the chamber pieces that appear on this new recording. Can you talk about that? Where do we hear it? What should we be listening for?
Well, certainly, I mean, I'm not an expert on Indian music, Unfortunately, I mean, because it would be really helpful if I was. But what I've learnt from people in the field is that, say, the 11th Quartet, which is probably my favourite piece on the album, is based on the Shivaranjani Raga. So those notes which define the raga are used as the basic material for the quartet. So you hear it in the first movement and especially in the last movement as well. And what's really interesting about the last movement is that there's this kind of wild violin tune. And it's really a speeded up version of the tune that he wrote for All India Radio. And this is a tune that has been played since 1936 every morning on All India Radio. So it's been heard now by literally billions of people. When you think of all the Indian listeners who have heard it from 1936 to the present. And this tune that he uses for the All India call sign is sped up and used as the material in the last movement. So it's a kind of joke, and when it was played for the original audience would have known that they would have recognized that tune.
Is it true that most people don't know that he actually wrote that tune, so they hear it on All India Radio, but they don't know who composed it? Is that true?
I think people who have looked into it know that he had written it, but yeah, I mean, for the occasional listener, you don't necessarily search for the composer of the theme of the BBC or NPR or whatever. The call signs are not really identified as such. But this one has had such a long life that it's really become a kind of a part of the Indian consciousness, I think. And it's just it's really ironic that this theme, which kind of defines India, it was written by this Jewish guy from the Sudetenland. It's a very strange kind of cross-pollination.
Are all of the chamber pieces on this recording, were they written while he was in Bombay?
Yes, all of them were written while he was in India. I mean, he wrote lots of pieces with an Indian influence to them when he had left India. But all these works, in fact, most of his chamber music was written while he was living in Bombay. And we even know that Zubin Mehta's dad, Meili Mehta, was the violinist for a lot of the works that he wrote at the time.
I was thinking about the string quartet number 11, I believe, which you said was your favorite. And one of the things that struck me about that was the second movement. Which is just so beautiful. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Listening to that is a very personal experience. I mean, I hear some kind of reflections of India, but I also hear, this kind of European element as well, a kind of a sort of nostalgia, I suppose. We have to think that while he was in India, and certainly during the war, he had no idea what was happening to his family, his extended family, or his immediate family. And he discovered after the war that most of them had been killed. Many of them had been taken via Terezin to Auschwitz. One hesitates to kind of read in nervousness or worry or a yearning kind of quality, but you kind of do that in retrospect when you know what happened. So I kind of hear that somehow, but I don't know whether that's me, you know, projecting something that I know, or whether it's in and of itself part of the music.
The Sonata Number 2, Opus 44, had a real sense of urgency to it, I thought, and vitality.
What's interesting about his works for violin and piano, and there are a lot of them, is that he uses a kind of small amount of material, but manages to draw out of it an amazing range of feelings and dynamics and emotion without expanding on them. It's actually what I'd like to call it is like a sophisticated minimalism. It doesn't kind of knock you on the head with repeated figures, but he uses a narrow amount of material and somehow manages to draw out a range of possibilities and a range of emotional responses.
The Sonatina Number 12 is originally for violin and piano. The arrangement we hear on this recording, though, is for clarinet. What do you think the clarinet brings to this work that maybe is different than the violin as a soloist then?
It brings a kind of European, sort of perhaps a kind of Jewish ethnicity to the work. I know I wanted to include Joaquin on the recording because he's such a terrific player. And when I saw the line, and it's definitely a melodic line rather than a made-for-violin line, I thought, well, why not, you know, just give it to him and tell him to make something of it, which he did.
Is there anything you would like to say about the second quartet that's on the recording?
Oh, the quartet number 7. Yeah, it seems to date from very much the same time. I mean, if you look at the dates, you think they were kind of composed 6 weeks apart or something. But in fact, I think the 7th was composed probably, you know, a year or so earlier, and then, you know, completed round about the same time. It's very difficult to work out. He doesn't number his works. I mean, none of his works have opus numbers. In fact, I mean, one of the interesting things about Kaufmann is that he was an extraordinarily modest man. He did very little to promote his music. I mean, if you look at the archives, there's very little correspondence about, you know, when are you going to publish this, or, you know, please play my work. I mean, there's none of that correspondence at all. He moved from one work to another very, very quickly. As soon as he'd finished something and it had been played, whoop, he went on to the next assignment. So he was extraordinarily modest and self-effacing, and one hesitates to say unambitious, but he saw himself as a composer, and he said, you know, if people like it, that's fine. If they don't like it, well, that's also fine.
How do you think he might respond to this sort of revival of his music, thanks to the Arc Ensemble?
I've become quite friendly with his niece, Simone, and she said he'd find it hilarious, you know, that there was all this attention. He'd find it really amusing. He'd love it, but he'd kind of back away and think, oh, this is so silly, you know, what are you doing? It's that kind of sort of Jewish, self-deprecating, you know, I've got work to do, don't be silly, you know.
Unearthing the music of Walter Kaufmann with Simon Weinberg and the Arc Ensemble. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. Thank you to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Amacher.